Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilo Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilo. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, you'll hear a conversation about pancreatic cancer with Dr. Jill Lacey. Dr. Lacey is associate professor of medicine at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Anish Chagpar.
So, Jill, let's talk first a little bit about pancreatic cancer. Everybody worries about pancreatic cancer. I heard that it's one of the worst kinds of cancers ever to get. Is that true?
Unfortunately, that's close to an accurate statement. So what is pancreas cancer? So the most common type of pancreas cancer, the one that we hear about in the media a lot, is officially called pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. So this is a highly aggressive malignancy that gets its start in the cells that line the ducts of the pancreas and grows from there. About 90 to 95% of cases of pancreatic cancer are pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. However, there is a second type, much less common, about 5 to 10% of cases, that's actually very different. That's officially called pancreatic neuroendocrine carcinoma or endocrine carcinoma. That gets its start in little clusters of cells called islets that are scattered throughout the pancreas. Islets are little endocrine organs. They produce hormones. So pancreatic neuroendocrine carcinomas actually often produce hormones, such as insulin or glucagon, which regulate sugar, and hormones that regulate our digestion. So pancreatic neuroendocrine carcinoma, much less common, and is a very different disease. It is highly curable when diagnosed early, and even in patients who have metastatic disease or advanced pancreatic neuroendocrine carcinoma, it tends to have a very long, slow natural history. Patients can live a long time with advanced disease, so it's very unusual. Unfortunately, that's uncommon, so the common pancreatic cancer that we all hear about is pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma. And that is a very aggressive, lethal malignancy, as you alluded to. I think the statistics kind of tell the story about pancreatic cancer. So in the United States in 2014, we're expecting to see about 45,000 cases. And unfortunately, the death rate approaches that, so about 40,000 deaths from pancreas cancer. And although it's actually uncommon, only about 3% of all cancers diagnosed in the United States are pancreatic cancer. It is, in fact, the fourth leading cause of cancer-related deaths. So it falls behind lung, which is at the top of the list, colorectal, and now it's just about even actually with breast for third and fourth place. And what's a little disturbing is that in about 10 years, it's probably going to move into second place. And if there are no advances in the field, in 20 years, it will probably be the leading cause of cancer-related death. So this is really a huge problem for us.
Is that because the disease is getting worse or because the treatments are better for the other diseases?
I think it's primarily because we've made major strides in treating the other diseases, both in terms of early diagnosis with screening and better treatments.
So tell us a little bit about how advances are being made, because presumably advances are being made in pancreatic cancer to prevent it from getting to that top spot.
So I think the two areas where there is tremendous focus right now are in the area of early diagnosis and screening. So the only known cure for this disease right now is surgery. And unfortunately, only about 20% of patients with pancreatic cancer, when they are diagnosed, are able to undergo an operation.
So why is that?
So patients, 80% of patients are presenting with advanced disease. So why is that? It's attributed to a couple of features of this disease. So first of all, the pancreas is what I call a silent organ. It's a big organ that sits way in the back of the abdomen. So you're never going to feel anything. So breast cancer, you can feel a lump. You're never going to feel a lump in the pancreas. So a tumor actually has to get pretty large in the pancreas in most cases before it's going to cause any symptoms. Mm. The second major problem is biology. This inherently is a cancer that is aggressive. And by that I mean that very early on, when it's very small, it already has spread, or what we call metastasized, to distant sites in the body, such as the liver or the belly cavity. So those are probably, you know, the two major reasons why it's often diagnosed late. The other problem is that even when it's small, there are a lot of major blood vessels that run right around the pancreas. So sometimes a small cancer will grow around a blood vessel. That's a problem for the surgeon, and that also would preclude surgery, which, again, is the only known curative treatment. So there's a big focus on early diagnosis and screening, even hopefully diagnosing before you have an invasive cancer when it's pre-malignant. I mean, that's a long shot, but that's what we're hoping for. So early diagnosis and screening is one area of research. And then obviously we need better treatments for patients who present with more advanced disease.
So before we get to that second, I mean, just going back to early diagnosis, if the pancreas is, as you say, a silent organ, how exactly do you do that? Are we talking about yearly CT scans of the abdomen? Are we talking about, how do you diagnose pancreatic cancer early?
So it's a challenge. Right now, none of the consensus organizations recommend any kind of routine screening for pancreas cancer in the general population. Partly that is because we just don't have an easy, validated screening test such as a blood test like PSA or a mammogram for breast cancer or even colonoscopy. I mean, some people would argue that's not so easy, but it's a very effective screening test. We have nothing like that for pancreas cancer. That said, there's intensive research now focused primarily on looking for a blood test, perhaps looking for pancreas cells circulating in the blood or pancreas cancer DNA in the blood. People are looking at saliva tests. So a lot of research in that area, but nothing yet. Now, there are patients that we can identify who do appear to be at substantially increased risk of developing pancreas cancer. And those patients should be evaluated for screening on a case-by-case basis. So the screening modalities that we have are imaging tests, MRI and CT scan, and also a test called endoscopic ultrasound. That's probably the best way to look for pancreas lesions, precancerous lesions, and cancer. So many listeners are probably familiar with endoscopy, where the gastroenterologist will put a scope down into the stomach, look for ulcers or inflammation. So this is a very similar test. It's endoscopy with an ultrasound probe on the end of the scope, and that allows the endoscopist then to do an ultrasound from the inside out of the pancreas, and it gives them a very, very good look of the pancreas, and they can see lesions that are very tiny. And in addition, they're able to put a needle into that lesion using the ultrasound to guide them and get a biopsy. So it's greatly improved our diagnosis. So that's been a big advance over the last 15 years. It's also greatly improved our ability to get a biopsy, which prior to endoscopic ultrasounds had been more difficult.
So this would be something you'd consider in those people who are at increased risk.
Yes, absolutely.
So who are those people?
Okay. So there are a number of risk factors for pancreas cancer, well identified. Unfortunately, getting old is one of them. So about two-thirds of patients with pancreas cancer are over the age of 65, but about 15% are under the age of 55. Smoking is a clear risk factor. I think people think about tobacco and lung cancer and head and neck cancers, but about 30% of pancreas cancers are tobacco-related. Obesity and a sedentary lifestyle, risk factor for many cancers and clearly a risk factor for pancreas cancer. Diabetes. There is a link between diabetes and pancreas cancer. We don't fully understand it. Is it the horse or the cart? But I think there's more and more evidence that the recent diagnosis of diabetes or a change in diabetic control in a middle-aged adult is a risk factor for pancreas cancer. Then folks who've had chronic or long-standing inflammation of the pancreas, it's called chronic pancreatitis, whether it's from alcohol use or gallstones or even inherited pancreatitis, they're at substantially increased risk. Then hereditary cancers. So about 10% of pancreas cancers do appear to be inherited. And the most common gene that's been implicated is the same gene that causes breast cancer, the BRCA or BRCA family of genes, particularly BRCA2. So those patients are at substantially increased risk of pancreas cancer. There are some other inherited syndromes as well that have been well identified that are less common than BRCA. And then finally, if someone has had a scan or for whatever reason and they are found to have cysts, particularly cysts that are full of mucin in the pancreas, that's a big risk factor. Those cysts can be pre-malignant lesions. So in terms of who should be directed to a program that does screening for pancreas cancer, you look at their risk factors, and certainly family history is at the top of the list. And then anyone who's been identified to have these mucinous cysts in the pancreas.
Hmm. So anyone who's had a relative who has pancreas cancer should maybe be screened, is that right?
Well, certainly there should be a discussion about that. A careful family history in terms of cancer should be taken, focusing on other GI cancers as well as breast cancer and prostate cancer. And if there's any question, a consultation with an expert who's involved in screening for pancreas cancer. And most of the major cancer centers now are offering programs like that.
Hmm. And what happens if you have one of these ultrasonic and endoscopic ultrasounds and you find a lesion and surprise, it's cancer? I mean, that sounds like a horror story to me. What do you do?
Well, so in screening for pancreas cancer, they're screening both for premalignant lesions, which is the ideal time to make the diagnosis. Then there's always the challenge of when do you go in and do surgery. That's a difficult decision. If you actually identify a cancer, then the next step is to do the workup, and hopefully you will have made the diagnosis at an early stage. That patient will be able to undergo surgery, and that certainly will increase their chances for being cured. Unfortunately, of the 20 to 25% of patients that are able to have surgery, only about 20% of those are long-term survivors. Hmm. So it's more than early diagnosis. We also need better sort of adjunctive therapies to increase the cure rate for those folks who are able to undergo surgery.
Which was the second area of major advances that you started telling us about. So tell us a little bit more about what's going on in the field to really advance the therapies that you have as adjunctive.
Sure. So we'll talk about two major advances in the last 3 or 4 years for the treatment of metastatic or advanced pancreas cancer. I would, though, say that sort of the underpinnings for any major advances in this disease are going to come from science and research, understanding the very complicated biology of this disease, which hopefully will give us ideas about more effective therapies, such as targeted therapies or immunotherapies. But that said, the advances in this disease in the last 3 or 4 years have come from traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy regimens. So just a little bit of the historical perspective. When I trained a long time ago, about 30 years ago, we had one drug, and the average survival of a patient with metastatic pancreas cancer was about 3 to 4 months. About 15 or so years ago, there was a minor breakthrough with a new drug approved by the FDA called gemcitabine, and that was a very well-tolerated regimen that improved quality of life but only extended survival up to about 6 to 7 months. Now we've gotten the average or median survival in patients with metastatic pancreas cancer up to about a year. And this has come from these two recent breakthroughs with chemotherapy regimens for treating metastatic pancreas cancer.
We'll want to pick up on that after the break, but right now we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about pancreatic cancer clinical trials with Dr. Jill Lacey.
The American Cancer Society estimates that in 2014, there'll be over 75,000 new cases of melanoma in this country, with over 1,000 of these patients living in Connecticut. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key, and when detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable. Patients with advanced melanoma have more hope than ever before. Each day, patients are surviving the disease due to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers such as Yale Cancer Center and at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The goal of the Specialized Programs of Research Excellence, SPOR, in skin cancer grant is to better understand the biology of skin cancer with a focus on discovering the targets that will lead to improved diagnosis and treatment. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Dr. Anise Chagpar, and our guest, Dr. Jill Lacey. We are discussing pancreatic cancer clinical trials. Jill, before the break, you were telling us that for patients who've had surgery for pancreas cancer, you've been able to prolong their survival with new combinations of chemotherapy. Is that right?
Well, actually, the advances have been in the treatment of metastatic pancreas cancer. Hopefully, those advances will then apply to patients who've had surgery.
Gotcha.
So, two major advances in the last 3 or 4 years. So, in 2010, we learned about a large clinical trial for patients with metastatic pancreas cancer. In that trial, half of the patients received what was the standard of care, the drug gemcitabine, and the other half received a three-drug regimen, traditional chemotherapy drugs. They weren't new drugs, but they were combined together. That regimen is referred to as FOLFIRINOX. And the results of that study were really quite stunning. The patients who received the three-drug regimen FOLFIRINOX lived nearly a year compared to a half a year for the patients who received the one-drug gemcitabine. In addition, their quality of life was better because they were having control of their tumor-related symptoms, in particular pain. So that was a huge breakthrough. And since that time, that regimen FOLFIRINOX has worked its way from cancer centers into the community and is being widely used and without a doubt is changing the natural history of this disease. We have actually seen a few patients with metastatic pancreas cancer treated with FOLFIRINOX who are surviving now to 3 years. So this is something that we never saw before. So that was one advance. The second advance came last year, again in a clinical trial for patients with metastatic pancreas cancer, half of whom, again, received the single drug gemcitabine. Half received gemcitabine plus a newer drug called Abraxane. This is a drug that's used in breast cancer very effectively. And again, what we saw was the patients that received the two-drug combination lived longer, not quite as long as FOLFIRINOX, about 8.5 months versus, again, 6 months. So a very effective regimen as well. So now in the metastatic setting, we have two standard multi-drug chemotherapy regimens that have improved the prognosis for these patients. Obviously, we wouldn't call this a home run. We don't think we're curing folks, but patients are living longer. It's buying time. And in general, they're feeling better during that period of time because it's controlling the tumor-related symptoms.
Yeah, it seems to me that the FOLFIRINOX story as well as the Abraxane story are both stories of why patients ought to participate in clinical trials.
Absolutely. You know, we really appreciate our patients who are willing to go into clinical trials. It's often not an easy decision. And neither of these discoveries would have been made were it not for the patients that went into these studies. This is how we do make advances in the field.
Yeah, because I can imagine the patients might have looked at you when you were trying to enroll them in clinical trials and said, well, why should I take three drugs instead of one drug, even though these are standard chemotherapeutic drugs? Is it really going to make a difference? And yet they had twice the survival.
That's correct. And so, again, we really greatly appreciate our patients. We couldn't make advances like this without their involvement.
So what are the next clinical trials on the agenda?
So obviously, we have a long ways to go. Still, only about 5% of patients with this disease are surviving 5 years. So when you compare this to, say, breast cancer, it's 90%. Prostate cancer, it's actually 98%. Colorectal cancer, about two-thirds of patients survive 5 years. We have a long ways to go. And so progress is going to come through research, understanding the basic biology of this disease, which is very complex, as well as clinical trials. So we are actively engaged, obviously, in that endeavor here at Yale. So, for example, one of the studies that we have open here at Yale for patients with newly diagnosed metastatic disease is a study where patients will be receiving FOLFIRINOX. And in addition, added to that will be a biological agent that's called hyaluronidase. So what is that? That's an enzyme that breaks down this sort of scar-like armor that we often see around a pancreas cancer. And if you can break that down, the theory is that you'll get better penetration of the drugs into the tumor and more effectiveness. So that's one area of research, looking at this sort of scar-like protection around pancreas cancer that has created some challenges in terms of treating it, both in terms of drugs penetrating. It also creates a hostile environment for the immune system in terms of attacking the tumor. We are also now looking at using these two multi-drug chemotherapy regimens in the setting of patients who are able to undergo surgery. And the hope is that if we use these more active regimens either before or after, or before and after surgery, that we will be able to increase the cure rate, much as we're doing in breast cancer, where after mastectomy or lumpectomy, most patients or many patients will be getting chemotherapy. So if we can use more effective chemotherapy in pancreas cancer, maybe we can get that cure rate from 20% up to a much higher level. So we have two studies at Yale looking at that aspect. One is for patients who already had their surgery and come to us. This is, again, a randomized trial, so sometimes can be challenging for patients. Half of them will get gemcitabine after their surgery, and half of them will get gemcitabine and Abraxane, the two-drug regimen. And hopefully from that, we will learn that maybe two drugs will get that cure rate up higher. And then the second study takes a slightly different approach. Patients who present to our surgeons who have localized disease are able to have surgery, are offered the option of getting chemotherapy before surgery. And there's a lot of reasons why that may be advantageous in terms of increasing the cure rate. And the particular chemotherapy that is a part of this protocol is the FOLFIRINOX regimen, so a highly active regimen. So they get about 3 months before surgery, then surgery, and then 3 months after surgery. So those are some clinical trials that we're offering here at Yale.
Does radiation treatment play any role in the treatment of pancreatic cancer?
So in certain situations, yes. Where we have used radiation historically has been after surgery. It's becoming less clear over time that that offers much of a survival benefit. That's an issue that has been somewhat controversial. So we're moving a bit away from using radiation after surgery, and we're focusing on using drugs. But the one scenario where radiation likely has a very important role to play is in those patients with advanced pancreas cancer who have disease that's not metastatic. It's localized, but the surgeon cannot do surgery because the tumor's wrapped around a blood vessel. That seems to be a scenario where a combination of the active chemotherapy regimens followed by radiation seems to be extending survival. So that's a situation where we often will use radiation.
What about immunotherapy? You had briefly touched on the fact that the immune system plays a role. And I wonder, especially in pancreatic cancers where they have this scar-like armor, whether immunotherapies have any role or may be particularly active if we can break down that scar and help our immune systems fight off these cancers.
So this is a very exciting area of research for pancreas cancer. I think this is a big hope for us. So as many have heard in the media, there's a lot of excitement about immunotherapeutic drugs for treating cancers. There's a new class of agents called immune checkpoint inhibitors. These are drugs that modulate the immune system so that it can attack cancer in a very specific way. These drugs have been very successful in certain cancers, most notably melanoma and lung cancer, and they're now being evaluated in many other cancers as well, including pancreas cancer. We don't know yet how well they're going to work in pancreas cancer, but we do have at least one study open at Yale that looks at either one or two of these immune checkpoint inhibitors in patients with solid tumors, including a cohort of patients with advanced pancreas cancer. So a lot of research is focused on that. Another area is of research related to immunotherapies is trying to make pancreas cancer more visible to the immune system by using vaccines. So this is something that some institutions have been focused on for many years. Haven't made a lot of progress, although last year there was an important study that was presented at one of the cancer meetings where this is, again, in patients with advanced pancreas cancer who've been through the drugs, received either a single vaccine or two vaccines in combination. And it looked like the two vaccines in combination were associated with an increased survival. So maybe if we can do a combination of using vaccines to make the cancer more visible to the immune system, and then using these immune checkpoint inhibitors to turn the immune system on, that may be an approach that will yield some progress. So this is actually being undertaken at some cancer centers, a combination of vaccines and these immune checkpoint inhibitors. So very exciting area. I think the jury's out, and we're really eagerly awaiting results from some of those trials.
Sounds like somebody with a new diagnosis of pancreas cancer has a lot of a long road ahead and a lot of decisions to make, and it must be hard to negotiate, I would imagine.
So, I mean, there are so many challenges to treating this disease, as we've been discussing here today. I think it is important that patients have an interdisciplinary team that's involved in their care. It certainly often will involve a surgeon if they are able to undergo surgery. The gastroenterologist plays a key role. These patients develop a number of gastrointestinal complications from obstruction of their bile duct, obstruction of their stomach, obstruction of their bowel, and we need the gastroenterologist to help us manage those. The gastroenterologists are also very involved in the diagnosis. The radiation therapists often have a role to play, and of course the medical oncologists in treating the patients with systemic therapies or drugs. So I think having an interdisciplinary team is very important. I think navigating the system in terms of clinical trials is a challenge for patients. I think the first place to start probably is with a conversation with their oncologist. Should I be looking for clinical trials? At what point should I go to a major cancer center to investigate clinical trials? I think is the first place to start for most patients.
So, Jill, you know, we started this whole conversation talking about the dismal prognosis for many pancreas cancers. Just a few minutes ago, when you were talking about vaccines, do you think that there will be hope at some point for prevention of pancreatic cancers in people who are at high risk? We went through a whole battery list of people who are at high risk, and if we're able to find what causes these cancers, do you think we'll ever get to a point where we won't have to look at the dismal prognosis because we would have prevented the disease to begin with?
So certainly where we could make the greatest impact with this disease would be to have some type of preventive therapy. And then if we can't achieve that goal, early diagnosis through an effective screening modality. And so that's why there's so much interest in those two areas. Now, in terms of prevention, I think there's a lot of interesting research in that area. I would mention that just over the last few weeks, there was an interesting study that received quite a bit of media attention that came out of Yale's School of Public Health showing that low-dose daily aspirin actually decreased the risk of cancer by about 50%. A lot of interest in aspirin as a cancer preventive drug, and this is another disease where it may have a role to play. Vaccines, I don't think we're there yet, but certainly I think one can be hopeful that maybe that is the future for this disease.
Dr. Jill Lacey is Associate Professor of Medicine at Yale School of Medicine. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888 234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs are available in both audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support for this program, and we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.